The Israeli forces commit another massacre against Palestinian civilians in Gaza, killing over 60 people waiting for aid in the north of the territory. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says operations against Israel-linked vessels will continue in the Red Sea and will extend to include ships crossing the Indian Ocean. And Iran says Israel has failed to achieve its proclaimed goals in the months-long onslaught on Gaza, and the signs of its historic defeat are already clear. Thank you for joining us. Now, the Israeli regime has committed another massacre against Palestinian aid seekers in the Gaza Strip, killing at least 60 people and wounding 160 others. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, the massacre took place at Gaza City's Kuwait roundabout, where Israeli forces targeted some 30,000 aid seekers with machine guns, helicopters, tanks and drones. The roundabout has witnessed similar tragedies in the past. At least 500 civilians have so far been killed in Israeli attacks on people awaiting aid in Gaza. The latest incident came hours after at least 8 people were killed in an Israeli strike on an aid center in Al-Nusayrat camp in central Gaza. Gaza's health ministry says the Israeli genocide has so far killed more than 31,300 Palestinians, leaving over 73,000 others injured. Meanwhile, reactions are pouring in following the latest Israeli massacre of civilians seeking aid in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas says failure of the international community and the United Nations to take action against Israel has given the regime a green light to commit such horrific crimes. Hamas said Israel's massacres of aid seekers are part of its genocide and ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. The movement added that the U.S. fully supports the regime and protects it from any international prosecution. Hamas also held the Biden administration responsible for the massacre, as it openly provides the regime with weapons. It also urged international organizations to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza and take measures to get aid into the territory. Gaza's government media office also said Israel had attacked aid seekers for the 20th day in a row. It added that the regime is aware of gathering places of aid seekers and deliberately targets them. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier from Gaza's central city of Deir al-Balah with the latest updates on the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli warplanes continue their strikes against the residential buildings, particularly here in Deir al-Balah city and even Al-Burij refugee camp. The last and the fresh attack actually targeted a residential building at Al-Burij refugee camp. At least 5 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over that attack, while dozens are still trapped under the rubble. In the meantime, another civilian car was hit over the last couple of hours in Gaza City. At least 4 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over that attack. Even in Jabalia refugee camp, the Israeli warplanes also renewed their airstrikes and incursions against several areas. More residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli relentless airstrikes against that area. We are still talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes are still hitting the residential buildings, claiming more lives of the Palestinian people, while the Israeli starvation war is still continued and maintained, particularly when it comes to the food and aid distribution centers and elsewhere in Gaza Strip.
The European Union's foreign policy chief has urged the U.S. to put more pressure on Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. Josep Borrell also described the current humanitarian crisis in the besieged territory as a man-made disaster. Borrell played down attempts made to get aid into Gaza through airdrops or ships, saying they are less effective than land routes. He added that the U.S. must make Israel open more crossings into Gaza instead of impeding aid delivery. Echoing his remarks, the bloc's aid chief said airdrops and maritime corridors cannot make up for the aid that can be transported by hundreds of trucks. He added that there are pockets of famine already in Gaza. Israel stands accused of weaponizing starvation by completely sealing off Gaza. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has also said that the regime is destroying Gaza's food system as part of its starvation campaign against the territory. A senior EU official says Israel has not provided any evidence to support its allegations about UNRWA staff's role in Operation Al-Aqsa flood. The bloc's humanitarian aid chief, Yanis Lenarchich, called UNRWA irreplaceable, saying the agency has reacted properly and effectively to the regime's accusations. Israel claims that a number of UNRWA workers took part in Hamas's anti-Israel operation on October the 7th. The accusations prompted the regime's Western backers, including the US, to stop funding the UN agency. UNRWA has strongly denied the claims, saying Israel has obtained confessions from its staff under torture. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement vows that operations against Israel-linked vessels in the Red Sea will continue with high effectiveness. Abdul Malik al-Houthi added that American and British vessels will also be targeted until Israel's genocide in Gaza stops.
And the military operations will continue, whether with rocket firing, and the operations where we are targeting the vessels that are linked to the Israeli enemy, and as well with the implication of the U.S. and the vessels that are for the U.S. and the U.K. and the UK as well, and their aggression against our country in order to support the Israeli enemy, then our operations are also continuing against them, and our targeting is also continuous against them. This is all with God Almighty's support.
Al-Houthi added that Yemen's operations will further extend to include those vessels that cross the Indian Ocean towards South Africa's Cape of Good Hope. He said Yemen's naval forces have so far targeted 73 vessels in nearby waters. He stressed that the military aggression against Yemen by the US and the UK has failed to deter the country from carrying out anti-Israel operations and has had no effect on its missile and drone capabilities. Elsewhere in his remarks, Houthi criticized some Arab and Muslim states for their inaction in the face of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. He called on Muslims to stand against the regime, which is trying to turn Gaza into an uninhabitable land for Palestinians. Houthi reaffirmed that Israel has failed to achieve any of its goals in the blockaded territory. Iran's foreign minister says the Israeli regime has failed to achieve any of its proclaimed goals during its months-long onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the signs of a historic defeat for the regime have already become clear. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a message to the heads of Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Islamic Jihad resistance groups on the occasion of the advent of the holy month of Ramadan. Amir Abdullahian said the Israeli regime continues with its genocide and inhumane crimes against Palestinians, especially women and children in Gaza, during Ramadan. He said international organizations, including the UN Security Council, have failed to adopt any effective and deterrent measures against this genocide. Amir Abdullahian also slammed the inaction of the so-called advocates of human rights in the face of Israel's extensive crimes. The Palestinian Authority Prime Minister and his cabinet submitted their resignation a couple of weeks ago. Now, news has surfaced there is a replacement for the job, one approved by the PA President, Mahmoud Abbas. In our explainer program, we took a closer look at the issue.
The Palestinian President, Mahmoud Abbas, is set to appoint Mohammed Mustafa as the next Palestinian Authority Prime Minister. Now, this comes after the former Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shataya, resigned from office, paving the way for Mohammed Mustafa. But who is Mohammed Mustafa? Well, Mustafa is 69 years old. He's born in Tokaram in the West Bank. He holds a doctorate in economics from George Washington University in the U.S. He has also worked at the World Bank for 15 years. Other notable points of his resume: he has served as PA's deputy prime minister, the economy minister, and as Abbas's economy advisor. Although close to Mahmoud Abbas, he is not a Fatah member. Mustafa has also sat on the Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee since the year 2022. Now, he has also served as the chairman of the Palestine Investment Fund since 2005. This is important since he oversaw a fund with nearly $1 billion in assets. So that's a lot of money. Why is that important? Not only did he oversaw Gaza's reconstruction under Hamas rule after an earlier war between Israel and Hamas, Mustafa will be responsible for overseeing billions of dollars in expected international aid. The introduction of a new prime minister is part of an effort by Mahmoud Abbas to reform the PA, to create a technocratic government in the West Bank. Mustafa himself is widely regarded as an independent technocrat. He's been holding consultations with prospective cabinet members in recent weeks. The members are expected to be a group of technocrats unaffiliated with Abbas's Fatah party. For those that may not know what a technocrat or technocratic government is, well, it's one in which the ministers are not career politicians and they are experts in their ministerial fields. So hopefully that'll define that for you. Once the technocratic government is in place, regional stakeholders will be able to move forward with plans to establish an interim committee in Gaza responsible for providing civil services and internal security in the enclave to eventually govern the Gaza Strip after Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians continues. Well, there's some confusion in this stance, since Mohammed Mustafa has also said in the next phase what he will do was he would reunite Gaza and the West Bank. Okay, this is a direct quote. This means Gaza and the West Bank will be one Palestinian land, not separated actually by a border with Gaza. Well, the unity government will perform under a reformed government comprised of a new prime minister. It will be tasked with taking care of Arab countries and European donors. There's also a request for the PA president, Mahmoud Abbas, to transfer some of his powers to the prime minister. And finally, will Mohammed Mustafa get along with the Israeli regime? Well, check out this quote. If we cannot remove the occupation, no reformed government can build a good governance system. It doesn't sound like he and the Israeli regime are on the same page. You be the judge.
Nigerian Muslims, like millions of others worldwide, are fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. However, the rising cost of living in the country has caused significant challenges for many Nigerian Muslims during this fasting period. Don Juma Abdullahi reports.
Ramadan, a sacred month in Islam, is a month to cultivate self-discipline, self-control, sacrifice, and empathy for those in need. Breaking of the fast in the evening, known as iftar, also fosters a sense of community and sharing as people come together to share a meal. Here in Nigeria, many Muslims are observing the month of Ramadan with fasting while grappling with the economic hardships plaguing the country. The Naira, Nigeria's currency, experienced a historic decline against the dollar in February this year, leading to a rampant inflation that has rendered life exceedingly difficult for many Nigerians. Many people experience hunger before bedtime, making fasting during Ramadan a formidable challenge. Experts assert that there exists a fundamental issue that requires urgent attention. Religious organizations like the Al-Habibiyya Islamic Society have established the food bank, where Muslims donate both money and food to support the less fortunate during Ramadan. Dedicated volunteers cook and package meals, ensuring that hundreds of impoverished fasting Muslims receive a warm meal for iftar in the evening.
Our purpose here is to improve lives through the support of Allah. With utmost humility and sincere gratitude to the Almighty Allah, things are now getting better for us. Yesterday, we provided meals for 2,200 people. On the first day of Ramadan, it was 1,600, and on the second day, it reached 2,002. Only God knows the count for today.
The Nigerian government has recognized the food challenge and has moved to address it. This is in addition to other critical measures. Beyond palliatives, experts say the Nigerian government must have the right mix of fiscal and monetary policies in order to get out of the economic situation. They say more than 60,000 hectares of farmland have been abandoned in northern Nigeria because of the banditry and kidnapping. The government needs to address the general insecurity in Nigeria. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Conflict in Ukraine has led to a major restructuring of the global weapons market, according to a new report from a top NGO dedicated to peace. Europe has doubled their arms imports in recent years, with Russia dropping from its long-time number two spot behind the United States. Rami Mazahiri reports from Paris.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade.
For us, it's a little paradoxical that a nation which claims to be a country which greatly respects human rights is also a nation which is so very proud of its weapon sales. It's clear that the values of the French people and human rights are subservient to geostrategic interest, and we shouldn't celebrate France's arming of often dictatorial regimes.
Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere.
D'exposer son matériel de guerre.
French arms in Africa allows France to show off their latest weapons and present them as combat proven. So Africa is not just a show window for French arms, but also a testing laboratory, and with always destabilizing results for the continent.
This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries.
Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulema, Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued his job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam in humanity. In the third episode of Ramadan special series, we are going to explain Ayah 64 of Surah Ali Imran of the Noble Quran. This ayah is about inviting the people of the book to unity and commonalities. Stay tuned, please. The blessed month of Ramadan is the exceptional opportunity with unique moments, particularly in the midnight and dawn. Among the beauties of this world are differences in the nature of human beings. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that every human is a vast world of thoughts, moralities, and tastes. But the point to note is that differences should not cause distance or enmity and spite among individuals. For instance, consider a vast country where differences cause separation and hostility, and the previous power and solidarity will perish and the country might be disintegrated. Imagine one day in which all Christians, Jews, and Muslims are united and rise up against oppression and injustice. Will there remain injustice anymore? God tells the Prophet in Ayah 64 of Surah Ali Imran, "Say, O people of the book, come to the word common between us and you, that we will worship no one but Allah, and that we will not ascribe any partner to him, and that we will not take each other as lords besides Allah." In this ayah, Allah calls for unity. Unity means to put aside whatever has entered religion as distortion and made it toward polytheism. It means to cling to the fundamental principle, that is monotheism. What causes rift and disunity is to follow those who distort religion purposefully and consciously. There have always been people in history who intend to discord among people. In addition, we live in the digital age, which has yielded individualism. People who are plunged in the cyberspace believe that the best way for achieving happiness and success is to pursue one's vested interest and personal desires. In other words, what is the use of it for me? Is the main concern and question for such people. But how can we rescue human communities from these crises? It seems that sympathy, cooperation, and attachment to one another is the best antidote for individualism and egotism. God says in Ayah 103 of Surah Al-Imran, "And hold fast to Allah's cord, all together, and do not be divided. And remember Allah's blessing upon you when you were enemies. Then He brought your hearts together, so you became brothers with His blessing." Interestingly, the capitalist world and Western liberalism claims to make unity based on common interest among humans, whereas this is not unity. It is rather contradiction and enmity, because whoever intends to gain more profit considers others as troublesome and enemy. So, he cannot feel sympathy and cooperate with him. Unity and cooperation materializes around obedience of God and the Prophet. In the Battle of Badr, Muslims fought with trust in God and triumphed in spite of being small in number. Then, in order to prevent Muslims from being trapped in rivalry for gaining more war booties and worldly gains, Allah said in Ayah 46 of Surah Anfal, "And obey Allah and His Apostle, and do not dispute, or you will lose heart and your power will be gone." Thus, obedience of God and the Prophet is the way for unity and solidarity. Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, said on this, "Allah ordained our velayat, authority and rule, the factor for solidarity and coherence of ummah. But the front of arrogance, the United States and its allies, administer the world through the old policy of sow discord and rule. In a clear and face-to-face battle, it is easy to recognize the enemy, but it is very hard to recognize the enemy in soft war and compound war. In such wars, enemies come to the scene with the visage of a friend." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha that once a man came to him during his rule. The man asked the Imam, "What happened years ago that your right was usurped?" Imam Ali, peace upon him, answered, "O brother, you are speaking undo words. Let me speak to you about Muawiyah. This shows how we should discern priority at any time and take the proper measure. To put it clearer, we should not be engaged in margins to neglect the main enemy. At that time, Muawiyah, son of Abu Sufyan, was the main enemy. Thus, the commander of the faithful abandoned his differences with other sects. It has been narrated that one of the Sunni inhabitants of Samarra in Iraq held grudge against Mirza Muhammad Hassan Husseini Shirazi, the great source of emulation of Shia Muslims over a century ago. The man injured the elder son of Mirza Shirazi and the son succumbed to injury. The great source of emulation showed no reaction. However, the enemies of Muslims decided to exploit the situation to cause a sedition and fish in the troubled water. They came up to Mirza calling for harsh reaction from him. Yet, Mirza Shirazi insightfully and smartly understood their motive and said resolutely to the British Council, "In Iraq, there is no need for the British interference in the affair that has nothing to do with them. You are not entitled to meddle in any of the affairs related to us Muslims and our lands. This is a simple issue between two brothers. We have the same religion, Qibla and Quran." It is good to know that the British policy of sow discord and rule and being strongly implemented in the Islamic countries. The 8-year war that the United States and its allies imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran through their suge, Saddam Hussein, was an obvious instance of this policy. But the insightful and smart leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, said in the heat of the war, "Whatever you want to shout, cry it out against the US." The founder of the Islamic Republic very sharply and foresightedly distinguished the arch enemy of Muslims and kept stressing all out struggle against it. He explained to the people that if there is a war in the region and if Saddam, Al Saud and Wahhabis are forging rift and causing sedition, the roots of all of them should be traced in Washington. The blessed month of Ramadan is the outstanding symbol of unity and solidarity among Muslims. Fasting in this month, like Hajj pilgrimage and rituals, unites Muslims and gives them a single color. Muslims from all sects gather around the obedience of Allah within the Islamic Ummah. Every Muslim considers himself or herself as a member of this great Ummah. They feel close to all brothers and sisters living in the farthest regions in the world. Let us obey the noble Quran and get united around the Prophet against common enemies.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. How about listening to a wise statement on fasting from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The easiest duty enjoined by Allah on a fasting person is to forgo food and drink. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what are we being invited towards in the holy month of Ramadan? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So dear friends, we are talking about what are we being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan. You know, what we're doing here on A to Z and trying to understand this Islamic lifestyle is to really understand the essence of, you know, some of the practices that we do, and especially the holy month of Ramadan, because of the great importance that Allah has given to the holy month of Ramadan. Of course, we find beautiful verses in the Holy Quran regarding the holy month of Ramadan, and we find many beautiful traditions from the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, and the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan and its beauties and its speciality and its priority, you know. But then, you know, eventually we come to this point and we ask, well, you know, what is it that we're being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan? We find that, you know, there is so much importance given to this holy month, you know, that this month is a divine feast. It is a divine banquet whose host is the Supreme Lord and the Almighty God. So what exactly is it that we're being invited to? Well, there are many various different things that we are being invited to, and they are related in the traditions of the infallibles, alayhim as-salam. But there's two things which we are specifically being invited to. One of those is forgiveness, and of course the other is blessings. Forgiveness and blessings. These are two of the main things that we have been invited to in the holy month of Ramadan.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about what we are being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan. We talked a little bit about how, you know, the importance of the holy month of Ramadan. We talked about how the traditions from the Immaculate and Infallibles, alayhim as-salam, help us to kind of realize how very, very important is the holy month of Ramadan. And then we said, well, why are we, you know, being told the importance and the priority of this holy month, the holy month of Ramadan? And we started to kind of, you know, delve into this idea that what is it that we are being invited towards in this holy month? And it is because we're being invited towards certain things that the importance of the holy month becomes known to us just a little bit. So we brought up two things. One was forgiveness, and the second one was blessings. Now, of course, you know, these are also aspects that are integral to our Islamic lifestyle, right? Asking Allah for forgiveness. And blessings really is something that Allah gives us when we decide to live a Islamic lifestyle. But when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan, we find that forgiveness is one of the things which Allah the Almighty is inviting towards. And of course, you know, we can be very honest with ourselves. Every single one of us can use a little bit of forgiveness. And if we want to be really honest with ourselves, every single one of us can use a lot of forgiveness. And to be honest with you, the more forgiveness that we can attain, the better it is for us, both in this world and the hereafter. The holy month of Ramadan is an excellent opportunity for us to be able to attain that forgiveness and really keep that forgiveness with us. 30 days in which we ask Allah for forgiveness, of course, after 30 days, this should become a habit. It should become a part of us. It should become, you know, like our flesh and blood, that asking for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah. But asking is one side. The beauty about the holy month of Ramadan is that Allah says, I will give you forgiveness and I will give you blessings. And so this kind of starts to show us a glimmer of the importance of the holy month of Ramadan. And this, dear friends, is what we are being invited towards, blessings and forgiveness.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
More than 30,000 Palestinians have so far been killed in Israel's full-blown campaign of genocide against Gaza since October 7th last year. The war, like any other Israeli action, has received full support from the United States. But the amount of U.S. support for this particular war has been consequential, and the death and destruction caused by it have been horrendous. The U.S. support for Israel's bloodshed has been so unconditional that it has prompted the closest allies of Washington and Tel Aviv to speak up and urge an end to the American administration's blind backing for the Israeli regime. In this episode of the program, we'll take a look at how the United States is liable for genocide in Gaza as much as the Israeli regime is, in a nutshell.
The United States has been using its veto power at the United Nations Security Council to protect the Israeli regime. As a result, Israel's killing machine has been able to keep going unfazed despite the atrocious conducts of war, which has resulted in the incredibly high civilian death toll. The U.S. first vetoed a draft Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in October last year, days into the war.
The Brazilian-drafted text was killed on October 18th, and along with it, hopes that the mass murdering of the Palestinians would stop. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that the veto was because the draft did not mention what she called Israel's right to self-defense. Already, over 3,000 Palestinians had been killed.
Then, on December 8th last year, Washington rejected another Security Council resolution aiming to mandate a ceasefire in Gaza. Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN Robert Wood said that text was rushed and ignored U.S. demands. The Palestinian death toll at the time was 17,400. The third U.S. rejection of a ceasefire came on February 20th, when Thomas Greenfield bizarrely claimed any ceasefire would jeopardize U.S. negotiations with the warring sides. The Palestinian death toll kept mounting, and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza grew worse.
The U.S. stonewalling at the Security Council came even as votes at the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly called for a ceasefire. While resolutions agreed at the General Assembly are non-binding, they carry political weight and reflect the international community's real stance on the Israeli war. But the United States' callous posture and utmost disregard for civilian loss of life has not been limited to vetoes at the Security Council.
U.S. officials have been making numerous trips to Tel Aviv to show support for the regime. U.S. President Joe Biden made a wartime visit to Israel in a dramatic show of support in October last year. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made several visits to Tel Aviv since the war started. U.S. support for the war has been more than those vetoes and official visits. The United States has been replenishing the Israeli arsenal, which would have gone dry days into the war, given the intensity of the bombardments and other military operations in the densely populated Gaza. U.S.-made military hardware of all kinds has been flowing into Israel, from ammunition for small arms to missiles, land vehicles, and aircraft. While it is true that Israeli forces are involved in Gaza, they are essentially fighting an otherwise American war. As the war continues, a case of genocide against Israel is also proceeding at the United Nations International Court of Justice, what is also referred to as the World Court. The final verdict will probably take several years, but the fact that South Africa has filed the motion at the ICJ and is effectively prosecuting Israel shows how the international community is thirsty for justice. Four months after Israel launched war on the Gaza Strip, the regime is planning a major ground offensive in Rafah. Only one thing has made it possible for the war to go on for so long, besides the Israelis' vicious appetite for blood: American support. Without U.S. support, the Israeli arsenal would have gone dry and the Israeli economy would have collapsed early into the war. In this episode of In a Nutshell, we're looking at the crucial role that the United States is playing in the war. The war started after a surprise attack by Hamas on Palestinian-occupied territories on October the 7th last year. In the aftermath of the attack, the regime of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it would launch a war to destroy Hamas. Almost 29,000 Palestinians have been killed since then, including 12,300 children. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced to southern Gaza, where the Israeli military now plans to launch a major ground offensive. The United States has been replenishing Israel's arsenal by providing military vehicles, spare parts, missiles, ammunition, etc. The Israeli military has complete access to U.S. spying assets, and the Americans make sure that financial aid keeps flowing to Tel Aviv. Only last week, the United States Senate approved financial aid for the Israeli war worth $14 billion.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden was quick after the October 7 attack to emphasize Israel's right to defend itself. U.S. diplomatic cover for Israel hasn't changed. If anything, it has escalated. Repeated attempts by the United Nations Security Council members to hold a vengeful Israel in check have run into a stone wall, with the United States vetoing resolution calling for a ceasefire to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
The United States has also repeatedly called a South Africa-initiated case against Israel at the International Court of Justice meritless. Lawyers for South Africa have been claiming that there is concrete evidence to make a plausible case that the Israeli military has been conducting genocide in the Gaza Strip. The United States' quick dismissal of the argument came even as a panel of 15 judges on the ICJ, also known as the World Court, are to decide, and as any decision is likely to take several years.
Still, it is a sign of consternation on the part of the judges that they have already directed preliminary measures to be taken to make sure acts of genocide are prevented. It is a sign of consternation about the unconditional nature of U.S. support for Israel that EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell recently suggested that the U.S. cut military aid to Tel Aviv. He pointed to Biden's recent comments that Israel's military action was over the top and said if the U.S. president truly believed too many people were being killed in Gaza, he should provide less weapons to the regime. Aside from America's growing isolation on the global stage due to its support for Israel's genocidal campaign, the U.S. administration has also drawn the ire of many American people as well, as social media keep bringing in unfiltered scenes from Gaza. Many protests have been held over the past months in different cities, demanding that the Biden administration stop backing the bloodshed. The United States' role in the war is so crucial that it is not hard to imagine the Israeli soldiers effectively fighting an American war. And while the ICJ case is not considering material U.S. support for Israel in the proceedings over accusations of genocide, it is conceivable that the enablers of the war would one day be held accountable on the world stage. Until that day, though.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Kids. Their little hearts are shattering out of fear. Explosion? Whose home was destroyed? Do you know the owner of the house?
Nights. Are they familiar to you? Anyway, they are a human. Just like you. You know, after every explosion, a kid starts shivering like hell and never gets back to the person he was before. Listen, the destiny of the people in this land has been interwoven with the children's cries for 75 years. Look at that mother. The mother who is pressing her dead child to her chest. And over there, a father is standing on the rubble of his hopes. Here's just the smell of blood and gunpowder. Do you know how terrible the smell of burnt soil, the traces of blood everywhere, homelessness, darkness, starvation, and thirst is? A mother moans, a father screams, and a kid is no longer laughing. I'll narrate them. I will narrate the wounds which need time to heal. And the resistance will guarantee a bright future for them for sure.
Gaza Vibes.
Khalil, take a stretcher. Hurry up. Take him to the hospital. He's badly bleeding. Hey man, be resistant, okay? Doctor, we don't have anesthesia. We've run out of the medications. Be resistant. You're young. You have to live a long life, okay?
We have to amputate his legs.
He can't stay alive without anesthesia, Doctor.
We have no other choice. We have to rush. He has lost much blood.
We're running out of emergency electricity.
Just hurry up.
His oxygen level is decreasing and his heart rate is going up. We have to rush. We're losing him. We need defibrillators. One, two, three. once again. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, we lost him.
Come on, let's go. We have many injured outside.
I'm coming. We've run out of anesthesia and medications. What can we do? Doctor, there is a bullet in his back. Suppose he's no more than 8 years old. Hey, boy, be patient. Aha, oxygen. We need oxygen. He lost his consciousness. But has pulse. Oh God, help him. Oh God, we don't know what to do. It's a genocide against us. Genocide against Palestinian children and innocent people. Mohammed, we have no choice. Let the injured lie down on the corridor's floor. I have to go to Ashifa Hospital. The Zionists have struck the hospital and so many injured are left. Take me to Ashifa Hospital. We have to bring some of the injured to our hospital. Just hurry up. Look at the streets. The Zionists have destroyed everything. May God help our people. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Here, the road is closed. Continue the way on foot. Take the injured to the hospital. Just hurry up. Oh God. The hospital is struck. No water, no food. No electricity, no fuel. People had just come to the hospital to get sheltered. Why did they kill them? Why is the world silent towards such heinous crimes? At the end of the alley, carry the injured to the car. Adnan, we have to go to Al Auda Hospital tomorrow. Children are malnourished and need care.